Thank you very much for having me here. I'm going to talk about works made in collaboration with Marco Serone in Sissa and our student, Gabriele Spada, a smart, brave student that is going to enter the market this fall. So if you like the seminar, you can consider him. So Power of Series. So, So usually in physics, we except for a few cases, we when we try to solve a problem, we encounter the obstacle of not knowing how to exactly solve a problem. For example, in field theory, at finite coupling, unless for integrable models, we don't know the exact analytic solutions in general. So we rely on perturbation theory, which is the expansion of quantities around a particular point in parameter space, which we know how to solve it exactly, typically the free theory. So we write the quantity of interest as an expansion in the parameter, typically the coupling, or H bar in general. And in terms of a Paris series, and then when this parameter is small, we can use this expansion as an approximation of our quantity. Unfortunately, typically, these power series are not convergent, are divergent. And the associated divergence is basically in correspondence to a physical effect, which was first probably discussed in the context of the field theory by Dyson, from the fact that what we are actually doing is trying to expand a theory of finite coupling in a particular point, which is a critical point, the free theory. Indeed, if we take our quantities, for example, the coupling, and we try to analytically continue it to negative values, our theory usually do not make sense, it's unstable. So, and from the fact that we are trying to expand around a singular point, we naively expect the expansion to have zero radius of convergence, which explains the fact that why these expansions are actually only asymptotic, they're not convergent. More in general, actually, the actual asymptotic expansion of these quantities has a more complex expansion. It's not just a normal series, it's what is called a trans-series, which is a combination of a series with non-perturbative effects. This is an example of a trans-series. Sometimes it can involve also more non-trivial function of the couplings, like logs and so on. And indeed, there are plenty of physical relevant quantities that shows this kind of behavior. And maybe the simplest case in quantum mechanics is probably the double well. Everybody gets and knows that if you, for example, study the eigenvalues, the lightest eigenvalues of the double well, at the perturbative level, we find the degeneracy between the first two levels, the one localized on the left and the right, and the degeneracy is only removed at the non-perturbative level. So the asymptotic expansion of the first eigenvalues indeed shows off like a trans-series formula with a degeneracy in the perturbative part, and instead the splitting due just by non-perturbative effects. So so basically the study of this, yes?
What is the operative meaning of trans-series?
The operator?
Operative meaning, so if you have this asymptotic power series and stop it at some point, it will be a good approximation,
yes.
It's not like it gets better.
Yes.
How do the trans-series corrections
enters how to make sense. Yes, this is basically the bulk of the talk.
Okay.
If I don't manage to answer your question, you can ask again, okay? So indeed, basically the central point of the talk is actually to understand how this formula makes sense, in the sense that here we have a divergent series, we have an extra contribution which are non-perturbative in the coupling, so how to put everything together to get the actual formula we are interested in. Okay, so let's look at a little bit more in details about the divergence of the series. So we start from generic trans-series, and we look at the perturbative part. So typically, what happens is that the non-convergence of the series shows up from a factorial growth of the coefficients of the series, which shows a zero radius of convergence. And for example, in field theory, this factorial growth is associated to the factorial growth, for example, of Feynman diagrams. And it's typical of in situation where your quantity is represented by a saddle point approximation of an integral or a path integral. So, so if you truncate the series, so if you try to take this perturbative series, so you consider the truncated series as some order n. For small coupling, the series, the expansion truncated at some order n first try to converge to the true result. But at a certain point, when basically the factorial growth wins against the power suppressions, the truncated series start diverging and start going away from the true result. The best approximation is reached when basically in, around this point, where basically the higher order effects becomes important. And this happens basically when the order n, since n factorial goes like n to the n, is of order 1 over lambda. So the best approximation you can get from such a series by truncating just the series naively is by stopping the series at an order which is 1 over lambda. And then the result you'll get is approximated up to correction, which goes like e to the minus 1 over a lambda. And this comes from the fact that here you have basically a behavior which goes like e to the n, and n is of order 1 over lambda. So this is the best you can do by just truncating the perturbative series in this kind of situation. So for normal field theory, for example, QED, this is not an issue because coupling is of order 10 to the minus 2, so it means that you can go to 100 loops before encountering this problem. QCD at low energy is much worse because you already have 2-3 loops. For small enough energies, you start seeing the divergence of the series. Which means that basically this is the signal that other effects should enter to cure the behavior, maybe. Now, how to make sense of this perturbative series since it's diverging? So one way is what is called Borel summation. It's the following procedure. Let's consider the initial power series. Let's consider another power series, which is just the initial one, constructed by the initial coefficients, rescaled by a factorial growing factor. Here, a gamma function of n plus 1 plus some parameter b, free parameter. Okay? So this, because of this factorial growth that you rescale in the coefficients, now this series, if Zn only grows up to factorial, has a finite radius of convergence. So it means that it's analytic around the origin. So it uniquely defines a meromorphic function, an analytic function, which is defined from the analytic continuation of this series. And I call this BBZ of t, okay? This is definition of this function here. So how this function helps to reconstruct the true answer? Well, let's take the Laplace transform of this function B of 0, calculate a lambda of t, which means just the integral between 0 and infinity of e to the minus t times this. And this defines a function ZB of lambda with a special property, which is that if you try to do now the power expansion of this function, you expand in lambda. At each order, you see that you expand this integrand in power series. And the integrand dt basically reconstructs the gamma function, which simplifies. And you recover the initial power expansion. So what we have done is starting from the coefficient of the perturbative series to construct a function which has exactly the same power series as the one we are looking for. Of course, this does not guarantee that this function here coincides with this. because they can differ by effects that are not captured by the coefficients. Also, this procedure may fail if the analytic continuation of this series, this Borel function here, BZ, has singularities on the path of integration. So in general, this B of Z, which is just constructed from this series, will have singularity cuts somewhere in the complex plane, in the complex lambda t plane. If there are no singularities in the path of integration between 0 to infinity, and if B doesn't grow too much at infinity, then the integral is well defined. This procedure is well defined. ZB is well defined for any lambda, and reconstruct a function with the same perturbative expansion as the one we're looking for.
So what did you assume about the original function, about the analyticity properties of the original function?
So far, I didn't specify anything. I'm just using the perturbative. Then I will discuss particular cases where we know more about the function. For the moment, I'm just using these coefficients, not the entire function. So it's not specified yet. So in this case, what I find is a way to reconstruct another function which has the same perturbative
expansion. But you assume that the second one does converge, is that right?
Which one? This one?
Yeah.
This, by construction, if this coefficient grows at most factorially, now this series has a finite radius of convergence, so I can construct Now, on the other hand, it might happen that this function B, constructed in this way, has singularities on the path of integration. This is an obstruction to construct this function Z of lambda. You can do a deformation of this procedure by deforming the contour of integration above or below the singularity on the real axis. This is called lateral Borel resummation. This procedure is ambiguous because depending on how you which path you take, the one above or one below, you get different answers. The difference is basically the difference between this integral and this integral, which is basically the integral around the singularity. If the singularity lies on some finite point here on the finite axis, a lambda t fixed, the ambiguity will be of order e to the minus t. If lambda t is a constant, it will be of order e to the minus b over lambda. So again, a non-perturbative effect. So this singularity is here, this ambiguity in the resummation of this perturbative series here, basically signal the presence of non-perturbative effects, which must be there to cure the ambiguity.
Can I just ask a little b in your formula? It seems to be arbitrary at this point.
Here?
No.
Next one.
Here.
The small b. No, little b.
Second.
Yes. This b is arbitrary, indeed, but it always simplifies out. So the final answer will not depend on small b.
What's the point of introducing it?
No, it's just a freedom. You can numerically, you can use it to test how much your approximation is correct. It's a non-physical.
You call it ambiguity, but in principle, perhaps the correct answer could be some complicated one in part.
Yes. Yes. It's the ambiguity might be even more complex, yes. So far, I'm not able to actually prove whether this procedure will reconstruct the full answer or not. Because basically, this question is ill-defined unless I give you, beside the coefficients of the perturbative series, some non-perturbative information about the quantity I want. So for this reason, I now will concentrate on particular class of function Z lambda that admits an integral representation of this form. I'm going to consider Z lambda, which are simple one-dimensional integrals in dx from minus infinity to infinity of some function g of x, which I assume here regular, times e to the minus f over lambda. Assume that this integral is convergent, and that lambda enters only in this particular way. Okay. So for the for simplicity on for convenient on the procedure I'm going to follow, let's rewrite this integral as a contour integral in the complex plane by analytically continuing the integrand on the complex plane x into z. So this is the complex z plane, and I'm going to integrate in this case along the real axis c of x. So there is basically the expansion of this quantity in lambda corresponds to the saddle point approximation for this integral. And the theory of saddle points is basically part of a mathematical theory, a theory known as Picard-Lesch's theory, which gives you the proper way to implement the saddle point approximation for saddle point method for this kind of integrals. And I'm going to sketch for those of you who are not familiar with it. So the procedure is the following. So you take the exponent function here, f of z, take the real part, and study where the real part is exploding, in particular when the real part of f is going to minus infinity. If the real part of f is going to minus infinity, basically this identifies the regions where this integral is not convergent. So let's assume that there are some regions for which the real part of f goes to minus infinity, so that in this direction the integral will not be, if I deform the integral on this direction, will not be convergent. Let me cut out this part of the regions from the complex plane. If I cut out this part of the regions, now the leftover will have a non-trivial topology. Then let me identify the critical point of f, which means the saddle points, the points where the first derivative of f vanish. General will be some. And for each saddle point, I'm going to draw the steepest descent path, the path where the real part of f basically is growing the most. And this path will go to infinity along the region where the integral is convergent, because when the real part of f grows to infinity, the integral is convergent. Now the question is how you decompose your initial integral into a sum of paths which passes through the saddle points, into a linear combination of steepest descent paths. So the steepest descent paths are also called thimbles, a higher dimensional picture of them. And so the question is how you decompose the original path of integration into a sum of thimbles. And this is explained by the theory of Picard-Lefschetz, which actually proved that these thimbles represent a complete basis of cycles in this non-trivial topology, which means that any other cycle can be written as a combination of them. An explicit procedure to extract which saddle will contribute, which steepest descent path will contribute this linear combination.
When you say cycles, is that sort of cycles relative to infinity, or
yes,
thinking of infinity as
contract? Yes, I contract on a sphere. And,
is there a natural orientation on the thimbles?
Is there natural?
Orientations.
Yes, yes.
Which goes from where?
The orientation.
Well, there is, you choose the orientation, and then that will fix. So the procedure works as follows. You draw the dual of these cycles, which are the steepest ascent path, which are those that instead go where the real part goes to minus infinity. And they intersect, typically they intersect the steepest descent path on a point, which is the saddle, which is the critical point where the gradient is not well defined. And then it's simple to show that the only paths that will contribute to this linear combination are those corresponding to a stipend ascent path which intersects your path of integration. So for example, this shadow will contribute because there is a non-trivial, this stipend ascent path intersect the real axis, while this one will not intersect the real axis, so it will not contribute. In particular, this does not contribute, this does not contribute, while all the others contribute. And indeed, so you can remove the two that do not contribute, and you can see indeed that the original path of integration can be continuously deformed into the sum of this steeper descent path. OK, so this is the procedure to decompose your initial path of integration that you can always do into a sum of integrals with some linear combination, these coefficients that are fixed by these intersections, of integrals defined, each defined on the steeper descent path. OK, now we are going to focus on each of these integrals. So we are going to restrict the original integral over each of these steeper descent paths. Before doing that, let me discuss a subtlety that occurs in special cases where this a steeper descent path starting from one saddle point hits another saddle point. So let's imagine that you start from a saddle point and the steeper descent path hits another saddle point. The other saddle point will have in general a steeper descent path going another direction. But of course, if this, the steeper descent path coming from here hits this guy, the steeper ascent path of this guy will basically coincide with the steeper descent of the other. Because the real part of F is, in this case, is increasing in this way, and the other one is increasing. So in this special situation, basically, the intersection number between these cycles are not well defined. So a way to avoid this difficulty is to analytically continue the parameter lambda, giving a small phase, which will upset this tuned situation where the steeper descent path hits the other saddle point. For example, if you give a positive phase to lambda, this will be enough to avoid the steeper descent path. So in this case, your original path of integration will intersect both steeper descent paths, which means that both this and this will contribute. Indeed, you can see that the black line can be deformed into the sum of this path and this path. You can deform it on the opposite way. Oh. Now the steeper descent path will go the other way. The steeper ascent will go the other way. So only one will contribute. And indeed, that this black line can be deformed only in the sum of these. So you see that these situations represent like critical lines that are called Stokes line, where there is a jump in the number of saddles in the steeper descent path that contribute to your integral. Of course, the integral is continuous. The result you get is the same, but it will come from a different combination of contributions. In particular, there is a jump in the intersection number. There is a jump on the number of saddles that contribute. At the same time, there is a jump in the integral of each saddle point. For example, you see that in one case, the integral over this steeper descent path will be some value. In the other case, will be a completely different value. Will be the integral over here. The difference between this and this is exactly the other steeper descent path. And this relation between the jump of these two integrals with the integral over the other steeper descent path plays an important role, as we will see.
Because the Stokes phenomenon is more general than just giving lambda a phase. I mean, in general, you have a function. Depends on parameters.
Many parameters.
And if you dial those parameters, you can have this.
Yes, yes, as well. Yes, yes.
Jump. So,
yes. Yes. Well, this lambda is a particular case with a particular parameter. OK, so now let's go back to the integral over each steeper descent path, over each thimble. And it can easily be proved that along this steeper descent path, the imaginary part of f is constant. Indeed, this is the reason why you also call the steeper descent path lines of stationary phase. So now we will prove that this integral leads.
About the higher dimensional case.
This is one dimension. I will discuss the other case.
Okay.
So now we'll prove that the perturbative series around of this function here, defined on each steeper descent path, is always Borel-resummable to the exact result. And the proof is very simple. So let's consider this integral. And let's make the following change of variable. Let's change the variable from z to t, where t is defined as basically the distance between f and the saddle value equal to lambda t. Basically, I'm calling t the exponent shifted by the value at the saddle. So that the variable t is 0 on the saddle and grows as the real part of f grows to infinity. So if you do this change of variable, your initial integral will have, okay, a prefactor that is given by the value of the function on the saddle. The integral becomes an integral in dt between 0 to infinity. The exponent becomes just e to minus t. The prefactor g just appears as a spectator here in front, now as a function of lambda t. And because of the Jacobian in the change of variable, you get a factor which is 1 over f prime, calculated z plus or minus. Now you can recognize in this formula, basically, the Laplace transform, which was leading to the Borel summation. So you can identify this part just with the b of okay, b minus 1 alpha. This is little b, which in this case is this value here, of some function lambda t. So you see that as long as this b is regular in the path of integration between 0 and plus infinities, this integral is converging. And it's converged to the exact result. We just did a change of variable. And you see that this function is regular, if g is regular, as long as f prime is different from 0, which means as long as your steeper descent path does not hit any other saddle point. So if you're not on a Stokes line, then the perturbative expansion around the saddle point is Borel-resummable to the exact result, where the exact result is the integral over the steeper descent path. And this also gives you an operative way to basically compute the Borel function analytically without having to write the perturbative series and resum it. Already give you the full analytic structure of Borel. Okay, what happens if you are on a Stokes line? So now your steeper descent path is another saddle, and your Borel function will have a singularity on the path of integration. At some value of t positive, this function will have a singularity. The value of t where the singularity appears is basically the value of this function. It's the value of the f calculated at the other saddle point. So which means that the Borel function will have a singularity, and the ambiguity associated to this singularity is basically e to the minus t on the singularity, which is this function here. Now, if you replace this guy here on the integral here, you'll see that the full singularity, because of this factor here, is just e to the minus f of z tau over lambda, which is basically the contribution from this other saddle point. Indeed, there is a one-to-one correspondence when you analytically continue lambda to complex values between the ambiguity of the lateral Borelli summation and the ambiguity in analytically continued the Timbor, the steeper descent path, on one side or the other. Mm-hmm. In particular, the jump of the steeper descent path that you have by going up or down when you analytically continue in lambda, the steeper descent path is just the jump on the Borel summation, lateral Borel summation, when you go above or below. Furthermore, you see that the power expansion, the original Borel summation, completely fixed the function B over all the complex plane. The ambiguity, which is basically related to the monodromy of the function, of the Borel function around the saddle point, the singularity, as we argued before, it gives you the integral over the other steeper descent path. So there is a connection between the Borel function from this perturbative series, in particular its monodromy around the singularity, and the Borel function around this other steeper descent path. Indeed, in this way, just knowing the expansion of this steeper descent path, you can completely fix, if after you analytically continue the Borel function, the perturbative series around a non-perturbative effects, the other perturbative coefficients of the other saddle points in the trans-series. So in this case, basically, the resurgence problem is trivialized. And basically, the relation between the perturbative series in the trans-series of the initial integral is just due to the analytic structure of the Borel function. So, okay, now to answer your question, basically, this trans-series just comes out from the decomposition of the original the original path of integration into Timbors. And each expansion is Borel summable. After you Borel sum, you put together according to the coefficients that you find with the Picard-Lefschetz theory. You the Borel summation of this will give you the exact result.
Here you mean that every instanton therefore corresponds to point on the real axis.
Every instanton in this case will correspond, yes, to integrals over the steeper descent path of other several points.
Yes, that is true, but to get this non-perturbative formation, you
mean
that it corresponds to a Stokes line. Ah, no. So otherwise you don't have that information to jump from.
Well, if you are not on a Stokes line, then you're basically these guys do not contribute, may not contribute.
Cannot contribute.
Huh?
Cannot contribute.
Yeah, they might
not contribute, or you mean?
No, there are situations where they can contribute.
There's a chance that they might contribute?
Yes, yes, it depends on which quantity you I'll give you examples. Where sometimes you have perturbative series that is Borel summable, but not to the exact result. You have extra contribution from non-perturbative effects.
Even though there's no Stokes?
Even though there is no Stokes line. Well, for example, this picture here exactly represents this situation. You see, you're not on a Stokes line,
yeah.
But the perturbative series around this does not give you the full result. You also have to include this and this.
So this trans-series is an initial right away from Stokes lines.
Yes. On the Stokes line, there is an ambiguity between how you do lateral Borel summation of each and the coefficients of the prefactors of each. Yes.
On the Stokes line, there are two representations.
Right. Yes. OK, so. So in general, there are three common relevant situations. One is that your quantity is Borel resummable to the exact result. One is that it's Borel resummable, but not to the exact result. And the other case is that it's not even Borel resummable. So the first case, for example, if you are in this first situation, then it means that you have only one saddle that contributes. There are no Stokes line, no trans-series. You have only a single series, which is Borel resummable. And for example, this happens if you have a real integral, and you have only one single real saddle. So if the function f is real, and there is only one real saddle, then the real axis coincide with a steeper descent path. So you don't have to deform anything. You only have that contribution. It's automatically Borel resummable.
The phase is constant. Is that the argument?
Because it's real, yes. So it's a stationary real. Second case is like the picture I just showed. There are more saddle contribute, but there is no Stokes line. This happens, for example, in most integral with purely imaginary f of x, for example, Minkowskian like integrals. So if you are away from a Stokes line, all the real solution will contribute, but they might as well be Borel resummable, each of them. Finally, the case where the quantity is not Borel resummable, that case, then you have more saddles that contribute. You are on a Stokes line. And this case is what happens for most of the real integrals where you have multiple real saddles. So in that case, you are guaranteed to be on a Stokes line. And then you have to analytically continue away and implement the procedure.
Sorry, what do you say that there would be no Stokes line for purely imaginary f?
I said that if you are Borel resummable but not exact result, then you are not on a Stokes line.
Yeah, but why do you think that would be the case for purely imaginary f?
So purely imaginary f, so if you have purely imaginary f and you have more real solutions, in general, the phase on each of the solutions will be different. So they cannot be on a Stokes line because you have on Stokes line only if the imaginary phase is exactly the same because they are on the same path. So in general, it doesn't happen. It might happen. Okay, so the discussion we just made can be extended to any.
Just one other question.
Yes.
Can you go back
yes?
to the second case?
Yes.
There are more saddle points, but each one would give a conservative series.
Yes.
And each one is Borel sum.
Yes.
So why do you say it's not the exact result? It's still the exact
result. No, if you only consider one.
Oh, no.
Yes. Yeah. Now, if you only consider the perturbative series, for example, round one,
okay.
Then it's not. Yes.
Well, I have a similar question on the.
Yes.
In the third case.
Yes.
Is there a genuine ambiguity that the Borel summation will not resolve for you? I mean, you had the two, you know, going over and going under. I just didn't quite follow that. Does it mean there's actually more information beyond the perturbation series that you need in order to get the right answer?
It might depend. There are special. Yeah.
Naively, you might say the two representations of the same answer.
Yes.
With different numbers of saddles, like in your examples, but both are valid.
Yes. Well, the original function is well defined
right.
for any lambda.
Right.
Now, the way you decompose it in thimbles, it may be different if you analytically continue one way or the other.
Yes.
But the limits will be the same.
Right. But suppose you only know the perturbative coefficients about
yes.
the saddle point.
Right. If you only if all you know of something is just a perturbative,
like it would be a field theory. Right?
Yeah, but. Yes. So if you only know the perturbative coefficients, there is no way to extract a non-perturbative answer because you have to specify how you, which contour of integration.
That's what I thought.
Right. Yes. You need some non-perturbative information, either given by Picard Lefschetz, it tells you which combination of thimbles you are implementing, or some other like analytic structure of the answer. Okay, so the discussion I just made for one-dimensional integral, it can be readily extended to n-dimensional integrals. Of course, I'll not show any plots, because now the thimbles will be n-dimensional. The intersection, we have to calculate intersection between n-dimensional surfaces. But the whole discussion follows very similarly.
One other I guess it's the same question. Is this, you had this claim that you could look at the steepest ascent paths in order to get the coefficient. Is that just a way, if you of finding the coefficients and expanding your homology, in other words, if you knew the original contour, what the new combination it was of the other,
yes,
then you don't need the steepest ascent at all.
Yes.
It's just a trick.
Yes.
It's a useful trick for getting the coefficients.
Exactly. To compute the intersection.
Yes.
Okay, so in n dimensions, then you can proceed as before. You have to decompose your original path of integration into steeper descent. Now they are not paths, they are n-dimensional manifolds, thimbles. And again, for each of them, you can run the same procedure as before to study the Borel summability. You do change of variable, t, goes into basically the phase, the exponent, f over lambda. So you write the integral again as like Laplace transform of some function b of the Borel function, which is now an integral over all the other variables which keep the action fixed. So now they are integral over s n minus 1 spheres, n minus 1 dimensional spheres. So this is a compact integral which is well defined as long as you are away from critical points where basically f prime is zero and the delta function is not well defined. So as long as you don't encounter saddle points, the Borel function is regular.
So the question on the definition of the symbol,
yes,
it's a generalization of a steepest descent, but
right,
it would presumably need some choice of a metric on the...
Well, the metric basically determines
the steepest descent. So
yes, it's,
is there an ambiguity? I mean,
well, the ambiguity. Well, the met. I guess the metric will just change the Jacobian when you rewrite these integrals in terms of the variables on the tuple.
But it will change the path, the symbol.
No, the path itself, it's.
The topology symbol can change. You can change the metric, but the final.
Topology may not change.
No, it might change.
That didn't change.
Yeah. It's an arbitrary.
Yes.
Choice.
But the manifold itself, it's fixed.
Yes, but I think changing the metric, you could in principle get the thimbles to go in.
Which metric you now you're referring?
The steepest descent equation in the linear flow equation.
What's the
flow equation changes? But the
yes,
manifold.
The manifold itself, I think, is fixed.
I think
why?
It's an n-dimensional manifold. You know that the imaginary contract is constant, but that's not enough.
No, that's not enough. But there are flow equations which fix completely the
metric.
With the metric?
Yes, yes, yes.
Because you have to raise the index.
Right. Here, I think, yes. So you should assume the trivial metric.
But that depends on your choice of complex variables.
Yes, yes. And the symplectic.
Is right. It's an auxiliary choice. It's a freedom you have to choose a different metric. And you can make it a convenient choice. So in Witten's paper on analytic continuation of Schoen-Simon theory, he chooses the metric to his advantage to get this thimble in a nice way. But you're right, that it's an auxiliary choice that you have control over.
But the procedure goes through for any choice of metric.
Any choice, because you're getting a localization property on that metric.
Okay,
so once we wrote the n-dimensional case, now we want to study something more ambitious, which is to go to path integrals. In particular, we will study the simplest one, which are quantum mechanical path integrals, special ones, which are the Euclidean one, with the action, which is simply like one-dimensional particle x dot square over 2, plus some potential, which I assume represent bound states. So v of x will go to infinity for x. It's just a restriction to simplify the discussion. So by definition, the path integral is nothing else than the limit of an n-dimensional integral when the n goes to infinity. So this limit is maybe twofold. It can be a UV limit, it can be an IR limit if you're considering a past integral with boundary condition, for example, times it goes to minus infinity. For the moment, let me consider focus only on the UV limit, and I'll consider boundary condition which are a finite time. Okay, so this is definition, and the limit, at least in quantum mechanics, is known to not be too problematic. The only divergence is associated to the measure. So after you normalize the measure for physical quantity, all the rest is finite in the limit. Still, I will keep the limit manifest this way. So inside the limit, I have an n-dimensional integral. So I can run the procedure as before for n-dimensional integrals. So I can do, for example, let's consider, for example, this special case where S is a single saddle, real saddle point. So I can do the change of variable as before. We can go to variable t and write the integral as an integral between 0 to infinity of some function b, which is related basically to the original path integral as a path integral, which basically where the action is fixed at some value which is fixed by lambda. So this integral for any n, this integral is well defined, it's finite. And for n large enough, if there is only one point where the derivative of s is zero, which is the trivial saddle, then this integral is always finite. So there is, so this will prove basically that in this situation, the perturbative series is Borel resumable.
Is the derivative to the power of n?
Yes. Yes. So this derivative to the power n is stays there because for n dimensional integral, usually that b parameter grows with n. So you can use recursion formula to rewrite as in terms of some Borel function with a finite b, and this involves this n derivative. But this n derivative is actually there to make this finite. There is an n-dimensional sphere that is growing, and basically this derivative compensates, give you a finite answer in the large n limit. Okay, so here I cannot prove formally that everything is finite because in principle I should pass this limit inside the integral, which is always the key procedure. But for this special case where everything seems to be finite under control in quantum mechanics, there should be no problem in this procedure. So I assume that there's no issues associated to this. And indeed, we will check numerically in several non-trivial examples that indeed there is no surprise in this case. Okay, so now using the analogy with the finite dimensional integral, we can come up to the following result, that for a given boundary condition, if for a given boundary condition only one real solution exists, which means only one saddle point, then the asymptotic series for the corresponding observable associated to those boundary conditions is Borel resumable to the exact result. So for example, if you take the problem of a potential with one critical point, finding the saddle of this potential corresponds to find a solution to the mechanical problem with inverted potential in Euclidean space. And it's known that for any boundary condition, this problem has only one real solution, which means that for any boundary condition, there is only one saddle that contributes. So, which means that any observable in these problems have an asymptotic series that is Borel resumable to the exact result. Particular case is the anharmonic oscillator, which is a convex potential, which indeed was known to have a Borel resumable perturbative expansion. If you want, in this way, you are able to extend these results to any potential which have a single critical point in quantum mechanics. So if your potential doesn't have a single...
I'm confused by something basic.
Yes.
There you have one single critical point in the real axis, but why don't you have more critical points in the complex?
For sure you have an infinite number of critical points. Mm-hmm. because the partito is infinite dimensional integral, will have infinite dimension, infinite number of saddle points, complex saddle points, but your integral was real. So you are doing the integral on the real axis, on the real plane, hyperplane, and you have only one real saddle point. So the integration domain corresponds to a one thimble. So it's automatic. You don't have to do any deformation. All the other intersection number will be automatically zero.
It's only in the Euclidean theory. Right?
Only in Euclidean theory that you can do that.
Well, I had the same question. You. Are you doing the Lorentzian integral?
No.
Or Euclidean?
For Euclidean, there is this nice feature of Euclidean integrals that if you have only one real saddle, then you are guaranteed to, you can neglect all the other effects. For Minkowski, in general, will have infinite number. And it's associated to the fact that the Minkowski partito has inside a lot of observables. And then each saddle will extract a particular observable. Instead, Euclidean, if you want, it's... for example, already for the harmonic oscillator, you'll get an infinite number of saddles. Or for an anharmonic oscillator, you'll get already an infinite number of saddles in Minkowski. Instead, in Euclidean, you only have one saddle. So somehow there is like a huge Stokes line when you analytically continue from Euclidean to to Minkowski, where you get pass from one to an infinite number of saddle points.
You said something about more observables. I didn't understand. Only one observable versus many.
Yes. Okay. Is maybe this I can discuss with you because otherwise I will go too far. Okay. Let's imagine that we take a more general potential with more critical points. Now the issue whether the quantity you are interested in are Borel summable or not depends on the quantity itself. Depends on which boundary condition you impose to the problem. There are observable that are Borel summable, observable they are not. For example, if you consider the amplitude, probability amplitude to go from x naught to x naught after time beta, beta, this quantity here, for example, if you choose x naught somewhere here, and beta is large enough, for sure has more than one real solution. You can bounce on this side, or you can bounce on the other side. So this quantity, this probability amplitude, lies on a Stokes line. You will have a transseries representation. But for example, if you are interested in the vacuum energy, you can define the vacuum energy as a limit for beta goes to infinity of the path integral of before. When beta goes to infinity, for example, starting from x naught, which corresponds basically to asking what are the solutions that you start from x naught, you finish to x naught in an infinite time. The only solution is the solution that stays there all the time, because if you leave this point, you'll never go back. Which means that there is only one saddle point, which means that the vacuum energy, on the other hand, in this problem, is Borel summable to the exact result. If instead the two vacua were degenerate, like in the double well, now you will have another, even in this case, you will have another solution, which is the one that bounds in an infinite time and go back in an infinite time. And actually, you will have infinite number of them, bouncing any time you want, which means that in this case, even the vacuum energy will lie on a Stokes line. You have non-perturbative effects that were the one of the double well we saw. OK, so now let me go. A bit delay to the.
In these cases, if you deform the well to make it not degenerate, then compute, and then take the limit, you get the correct limit.
Yes. One procedure, you can do this. Another one is the one we're going to discuss, which is to deform perturbation theory in the following way. So let's assume you start from Euclidean path integral, for example, which leads to non-Borel summable result. You are on Stokes line, for example, the double well. So let me write the action now as a sum of two contributions, S naught and delta S. S naught corresponds to a potential which is convex, like the harmonic potential, which is Borel summable. And delta S is just the difference between the original one and S naught. So far, I didn't do anything. I just wrote it as a sum of two pieces. Next step. I'm going to replace this lambda with a lambda naught, which means I'm going to consider a different problem, different quantity, z hat of lambda and lambda naught, which basically reweights this part here by lambda over lambda naught. Now this is a quantity that depends on two quantities. It's z hat now depends on two parameters, lambda and lambda naught. And a lambda equal to lambda naught, it reproduces the original result. But at fixed lambda naught, the perturbative expansion in lambda now is Borel-resummable to the exact result, because if you fix lambda naught and you just consider lambda, you see that the only thing that matters is the action suppressed by lambda, so which has only one saddle point, and so it's Borel-resummable to the exact result. So the expansion for z hat or lambda lambda naught for fixed lambda naught as expansion in lambda is not a trans-series, is a series that is Borel-resummable to the exact result. So you can take this expansion here, Borel-resum it, then compute it at lambda equal to lambda naught, and you get the original result, even though the original result was including non-perturbative effects, a full trans-series. This basically corresponds to take the original problem of the double well, which is basically quartic term and the qubit term. The qubit term is responsible for the second vacuum, and reweight the last term by a lambda over lambda naught coefficient. So basically, you are changing the power counting of some of the interactions. The new problem has a Borel-resummable perturbative expansion, and then after you Borel-resum, you have just to compute the theory at lambda equal lambda naught, and you'll get the original. So this is a very trivial trick, but it works quite amazingly. So for example, consider the double well. As I said before, right, the degeneracy of the first two levels is suppressed by non-perturbative effects. Let's compute them, for example, at a small value of lambda, and compute at some fixed order in perturbation theory, like 200. In this case, the splitting will be suppressed by this number here. And by doing the Borel-resummation of the theory that starts from here and consider the difference as a higher order, you can able to start basically the first two levels with a precision which is 10 to the minus 8 to 10 to the minus 14, which is much beyond the contributions from the ISCA, which means that the deformed theory, the deformed perturbation theory, capture not just the first instanton, but a bunch of them with a very high accuracy. Actually, even you can do the same things also for the wave functions. So you basically start from the anharmonic oscillation, you treat the difference as higher order. You resum it, and you can, for example, reconstruct with the quite good accuracy the wave function of the first two, for example, for the first two levels, which are only split by non-perturbative effects. Even more surprising, maybe, is the fact that this resummation procedure works extremely well at strong coupling. If you go to coupling of order one, where basically you have an infinite number of instanton equally important, it's enough to consider like even four order of perturbation theory to get the full result with the percent sub-percent precision.
Just to make sure I understand, the dashed line needs to go through the maximum there.
No.
No.
The dashed line, you can put it even here.
So you can put it below, yeah.
You can put it below, you can even put it here.
Well, there is quite the mechanics that people use for computing this Rayleigh-Ray method, right? Where you have.
You mean Rayleigh-Ritz?
Yeah.
No, Rayleigh-Ritz is a completely different method.
It's exponentially precise as well.
Yes.
Maybe the way you would compute it, can you comment?
Yeah, Rayleigh-Ritz actually is a different method, right? Where you actually expand, you truncate the Hamiltonian. And so it's an expansion in the Hilbert space that you are considering. And you diagonalize the Hamiltonian.
So
here instead is still an expansion in the parameter. So the basically, there you are expanding on a physical parameter, which is your truncation of the Hamiltonian. Here instead, you are expanding on the coupling of the theory. So this still retain the analytic structure of the answer. The other method, no. The dependence on lambda is numerical, if you want. but it works extremely well. In natural simulation. Indeed, that's the method that we use to compare our numbers.
In this method, I didn't understand. You're expanding in lambda with the Borel summit. Are you not expanding in lambda not at all?
I'm not expanding lambda not at all. Yes, I keep it fixed at the value I want eventually to compute. I expand in lambda, and then after I resum, I fix lambda equal to lambda. So basically, it's like you have your original function as a function of lambda. It's not Borel resummable. You introduce a different function, which a lambda equal lambda naught coincide with the same as a Borel resummable expansion. OK, maybe for lack of time, I'll skip the other example. I'll go maybe to a more striking example, which is the false vacuum. You can do the same for a false vacuum. You can consider the perturbation theory around the false vacuum, which is known to be completely non-Borel resummable. There are instantons that are associated to the tunneling to the true vacuum. You can implement the same procedure. You basically deform the perturbation theory on the false vacuum, similarly to what we did before. You treat basically the difference as higher order. You resum, and then you compute it at the value lambda equal to lambda naught. And after you do the resummation, what you find is a value which is very close at the percent level, for example, using 200 order perturbation theory, to the true vacuum of the theory. So you start perturbing around the false vacuum, but after you resum, the theory is Borel resummable to the exact result, so will converge to the true vacuum of the theory. So you are able to extract a quantity that is completely non-perturbative from the false vacuum point of view from this resummation. So for conclusions, we showed how the interplay between resummation of perturbation theory in quantum mechanics and non-perturbative effects from the point of view of Lefschetz symbols. And basically, this helps to characterize more systematic way when perturbation theory is Borel resummable, when you expect perturbation theory to be Borel resummable, when instead you must include non-perturbative effects and how. And then we discussed this exact perturbation theory, this deformation of perturbation theory, which is able to reconstruct non-perturbative saddles by exploiting basically the fact that if you have a theory with a single saddle points for Euclidean time, then the perturbation theory is Borel resummable to the exact result. And very surprisingly, it works quite efficiently, even a strong coupling, because now the fact that it's Borel resummable to the exact result allows you to actually go to strong coupling without having to worry of inclusions by hand or an infinite number of non-perturbative saddles. It would be very hard. So for the future, we'd like to explore how to extend these results from quantum mechanics to quantum field theory. Here there are a number of challenges. One is associated to the UV, because now the UV limit is less trivial. You have to implement renormalization, which has to do with higher order corrections. And even more so, you can encounter problems like new non-perturbative effects associated to the renormalization itself, like the unknown, which has even less clear understanding in terms of saddle points. And also in the infrared limit is more subtle because of the possible presence of phase transition, which are non-ellipticities. So we are trying to explore maybe the simplest case, which is phi to the 4 in 2 dimensions, where renormalization is still not too complicated because the theory can be renormalized just by normal ordering. And it's known to be Borel resummable, at least for m squared larger than 0. And as a lot of rich physics, you present phase transition. If you go to large coupling, There is a phase transition where the Z2 symmetry is spontaneously broken. At very large coupling, there is a duality between the broken and unbroken phase. So strong coupling in the unbroken phase is actually dual to weak coupling in the broken phase. And the point of the transition, of the phase transition, is where the two-dimensionalizing model lies, which is in two dimensions is exactly solvable. And for the same example, there are new quantitative studies using other methods, like extension of the Rayleigh-Ritz method to field theory by this truncated Hamiltonian technique by Slava and collaborators.
How do you deal with anomalies?
Here there are no renormalons.
So what's the idea behind this? So what are the ideas to deal with
anomalies? I have none. So far I haven't yet thought about this. There are proposals that, I don't fully understand them, where they basically propose to take the theory and quantify on circles using some twisted boundary condition, which apparently produce new saddles that seems to scale like the renormalons, like fractional instanton. But I'm not an expert. So, and to end, I will show some preliminary results based on the computation by the student that extended multi-loop computation in lambda 5 to the 4 to 9 loops. For example, we computed the vacuum energy in lambda 5 to the 4 to 9 loops numerically. And this is a teaser of the results. So as a function of the coupling, the vacuum energy, you see that already for coupling of order 0.3, 0.4, truncated perturbation theory breaks down. The theory becomes non-perturbative around 0.3, 0.4. If you Borel sum, you get much better behavior. This is a 5, 7, and 9 loops. And the 9 loops for sample computation are coupling of order 1 differs by less than 3% with non-perturbative method based on lattice or So it's encouraging that with this resummation, we can actually go well inside the non-perturbative regime. The hope is to extend even further and see if we can catch like the phase transition and in previous structure. But this is still working for us. Thank you.
Can you say again, if you have a periodic potential and you expand around one minimum, can you capture all the...
Yes. So we didn't discuss periodic potential. We always assume that the potential goes to infinity. So for periodic potential, the discussion is more tricky because, you know, for periodic potential, if you have a minimum, you always have a maximum, which means that you always have on the Stokes line. You always have at least two real. So how to avoid that, we still haven't thought. So for the moment, we don't have like Saint Gordon.
This might be related to that. So let's take a concrete case. So what you're trying to compute, variant non-conservation in the instant and the highlight variant non-conservation in the standard model.
Yes. Okay. You went to the most difficult problem.
And you computed at the elites.
I'm not asking you to compute it, but is your claim that by these techniques you don't need to look at an instanton, or you still need
no,
to look?
For that case, it's more similar to what he was suggesting. Yeah. Already for the quantum pendulum, we don't have a concrete procedure to avoid the windings, the configuration which winds.
Okay.
So it still needs some new ideas.
Going back to your very early picture with the many steepest descent paths, is the claim that if you could apply this new technique of separating lambda and lambda naught, that you might not have to look at the other set of points?
Yes.
That's what you're claiming?
Yes.
You have a very good, somehow,
you get the exact result.
The whole Borel series knows about the other set of points in some sense. When
yes.
You separate lambda from lambda naught. That's what you're saying?
Yes, yes. Yeah, you can do with the one-dimensional integral, you can see explicitly how this works analytically, how the Borel function of lambda and lambda naught knows about the Borel function with lambda equal to lambda naught that has the singularity. This is we discussed a little bit this and we'll find more.
Okay.
Yes.
That's the second figure.